Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, in the first half of the 20th century, long before the internet and even before TV, there were far fewer stars and celebrities than we have today when we're basically inundated with them. Most were created by the big Hollywood studios. But one major non-movie celebrity was Charles Lindbergh, the first person to fly solo across the Atlantic in 1927. And then kind of hard on his heels was Amelia Earhart, the first woman to accomplish that feat in 1932. She was called Lady Lindbergh, in part because she kind of looked like him, but she actually became even more famous than Lindbergh. But she really became a legend when she disappeared during an epic flight around the world. One of the enduring mysteries of the 20th century was what happened to Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, on their around-the-world flight attempt in 1937. The story of Amelia Earhart was recently aired on PBS's American Experience. The producer of that show, Nancy Porter, is with us today to talk about it. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Appreciate you being on. Start by just maybe tell us about Earhart's early years and how she got interested in flying.
Well, she was always a very adventurous young girl. And at one point, she even slid down a snowy hill and went right through the legs of a horse. She just shot right through. So she was a tomboy. She was born in 1897. She became interested in aviation in 1920. She was in California, and her father took her to an airfield where they were having a stunt show. And he bought her a ride, and she said, "This is it. This is what I want to do." So she came back and took flying lessons and had to work driving a gravel truck and as a photographer, telephone operator, and finally her mother gave her a little money because she thought what she was doing was not very ladylike. And she bought a plane, a yellow plane called the Canary in 1921. So she had her own wheels by then. But she became fascinated when she had her first short flight in 1920.
Well, I'm glad you called her a tomboy because I was going to say that too, but I was a little concerned that isn't even an acceptable term anymore. So it's, but she clearly was that, though. I mean, you know, not too many young women in the early 20th century were driving gravel trucks. So, but by the same token, she wasn't, you know, a big, bulky, you know, NFL linebacker either. She was a slender young woman and, you know, obviously highly intelligent and imaginative and everything. And what were her early accomplishments? I mean, like her first flying record, what was that?
Her first flying record was in 1928, the year after Lindbergh flew across the Atlantic solo. She was living in Boston, and she had joined the aviation community of women there, and there weren't very many. She was identified by a woman who had underwritten a cross the Atlantic air trip. Mrs. Guest was going to fly herself, but she was too nervous that she wouldn't make it, or her husband was too nervous she wouldn't make it. So they identified, they're calling around and identified Amelia in Boston and asked her if she wanted to join this flight, which was the Friendship flight. I think it was from Boston or maybe started in New Jersey, excuse me, but to across the Atlantic. And she was not to be the pilot, although by that time she did know how to fly. She was to be the passenger. She agreed to do this, having no idea what she was in for, except for that people were telling her she maybe had a 50-50 chance of arriving. Well, I first took off and landed in bad weather in Nova Scotia and stayed there for about 10 days. And the pilot was extremely drunk, and they finally sort of sobered him up enough to get on the plane. And they crossed the Atlantic, and when she arrived, she was hailed as a star. She visited the queen, she danced with the prince, and she was hailed as a real hero. And she kept saying, "Wait a minute, I didn't fly this plane. I was like a sack of potatoes taking the log. I shouldn't get any credit for this." And so she was sort of embarrassed by this. But because it was a year after Lindbergh, number one. Number two, she looked like Lindbergh. So they called her Lady Lindy. And she just stepped into the spotlight and never got out.
Yeah, so it was kind of right time, right place. And I think shortly after that, because she was proud and ambitious and confident, she kind of didn't like being the sack of potatoes that was along for the ride and was praised above all of the other people who actually had a more active role in the flight. She wanted to do one herself, so I think she took a transcontinental solo flight shortly afterwards, and that was a big deal. That was her That was a real record as far as a female doing a transcontinental solo flight. That was a first for her. So that was something that was really a big feather in her cap.
Yeah, she just wanted to prove that she was a pilot. She could fly. And so she entered an air derby in California and flew to Cleveland and back and came in third. There were other women pilots at the time who were sort of well-known, maybe not as much as she was, but in pilot circles they were. And they felt that she had sort of flown on reputation less and less on practice. Hmm. So they didn't think she was the best pilot at the time, but she certainly continued. And so she did a few transcontinental flights. At one point, she was approached by her manager, George Palmer Putnam, who had published a number of books, including one about Lindbergh. He approached her after the Friendship flight and said, let's do a book, or you do a book called 20 Hours and 40 Minutes, which was the length of the Friendship flight. And so that really put her on the map, even though she wasn't the pilot. She had to prove herself, and she always had to prove herself, even at the very end. She was never satisfied. She was very restless. She grew up with moving a lot with her family. Her father was an alcoholic. She wasn't an alcoholic, but certainly she's flown with men who were, and that was sort of her downfall. She was a loner. She was very restless, and so she just had to keep upping the ante. And it wasn't just her. It was also George Putnam, who saw her as a terrific opportunity to have a new superstar to publicize and to send out to do lectures and speeches and sign books. And so she traveled around the country in a little car and was on the road for months at a time.
Yeah, so I think the key to her fame and the fact that we still know her name and talk about her quite a bit today, as compared to those other female pilots that you mentioned, whose names we don't know, but who were in some cases maybe better pilots than she was even at that time. The key was not only her ambition and so on, but you mentioned, you know, George Putnam, who was a publisher and a publicist and a very good publicist. So the two of them basically teamed up, and he kind of hitched her to his star and vice versa. And the two of them together really took off, and that made the difference for her as far as her legend, let's call it. I mean, you know, his product endorsements, and she was on the lecture tour, and I think she even got involved in promoting two airlines that later became TWA and Northeast Airlines. So, you know, she was really a mover.
He was really an Uber publicist, an Uber manager, and some of the other women pilots, I think, were jealous because she had a publicist and they didn't. But she looked the way she looked. She was very wholesome, pretty androgynous. She could be very elegant, but not frilly when she dressed up. And she had a sort of Katharine Hepburn look to her. Mm-hmm. She certainly wore pants. She was writing her book about the Friendship flight, living with George Putnam in their house. And I think that was the beginning, the end of that marriage, George's marriage, and the beginning of an affair between George and Amelia. Okay. She was at his house writing her book. And so at some point, they became lovers.
If you watch your show, on American Experience, it makes it clear that he was a difficult guy and a lot of people didn't like him. And he was brilliant in his way, but kind of prickly and hard to get along with. And he kind of could switch back and forth between being a tough guy and a crude person and a suave gentleman and businessman. So he was a flexible, versatile person in that way, right?
He could be charming and vulgar, you know, and eventually she married him. And it's not clear how she felt at the time, but he was very much wanting to marry her, and so she finally did give in. By the way, just to go back to what you were talking about, the airlines, she did a lot of publicity for these airlines that you mentioned, the early TWA. I don't think she was really managing. I think she, or even if Putnam was, I think there's Eugene Vidal, who she was working with, and I think that he was more the manager than she was. But she would greet the passengers getting on and getting off. So this was the beginning of, you know, passenger aviation. And so not only was she the solo aviator flying around across the country, across the oceans, but it was the dawn of passenger aviation. You could fly across the country in 48 hours.
Yeah, it wasn't an easy flight like we have today, but it was a whole lot better than trying to do it in a Model T, right? Yeah, so, you know, as you kind of alluded to at the beginning, she quickly became what today we would call a superstar. I mean, there were ticker tape parades, and she was mobbed by crowds wanting to catch a glimpse of her. It was kind of like the first, you know, like the Mercury astronauts. It was at that level, really. And so, you know, we talked about kind of the keys to her popularity, you know, her appealing personality and the fact that both she and her husband were pretty much relentless self-promoters. And third, as you said too, she kept pursuing new flying records. She wasn't kind of resting on her laurels and just talking about what she had done. And so, as I said at the outset, she did kind of repeat Lindbergh's flight and became the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic in 1932. So that was a big deal.
And I think the thing that made the most difference for Amelia was the newsreel at the time. It was just, this was social media as they knew it then. And so whatever she did, she was filmed doing it. And her husband, George, was head of Paramount. So he could film her all the time in this wonderful newsreel footage. But that's really how she became as celebrated as she was. And there was obviously the product endorsements and Lucky Strikes and her own luggage and her clothing line. But the newsreel put her on the map.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Nancy Porter, who's a producer of documentary films and lots of films, about The Legend of Amelia Earhart and a film that Nancy produced on Amelia Earhart's life that was aired recently on Public Broadcasting System's American Experience series. And so part of what's interesting about Amelia Earhart's life is that not only was she such a commercial creature, and not only was she such an accomplished and record-setting flyer, but she really was what would later be called a feminist. And her time, her ascendancy kind of her fame sort of coincided, I think, in American history with a period when women were beginning to ascend in terms of their power and their rights and, you know, starting with the right to vote. And so, you know, she was a member of the National Woman's Party and an early supporter of what became the Equal Rights Amendment. And, you know, so she really was a multifaceted person, not just a shallow person who was interested in being famous and making money by any means, right?
No, she had her first flight, the Friendship flight, 8 years after the vote for women. And so it really was the time when she could, and she felt very strongly that women should have equal opportunities and should take on work that men usually did and should delay marriage. She eventually was a lecturer at Purdue University, talked about women's issues, and it was in the air, but she was very genuine about it. Mm-hmm. And she was really an early feminist. She was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt's, and she established a group of women flyers called the 99s, and she was the president of that organization. So she did fight for women. That was sort of her hobby horse. But she fought for women in aviation and in science. She just felt that nothing should be closed off.
Yeah, and doing what she did. I mean, you know, it's clear when someone is flying a plane that whether you're, regardless of what gender you are, you're flying the plane. And so,
That's right. So
it's hard to say, well, you know, the woman should get, you know, less respect for that or get paid less for that. I mean, you know, it's hard to make that argument because you're both doing precisely the same job.
She earned her fame, and she was certainly well promoted, but she earned it.
Well, let's talk about her around the world flight, which is kind of the thing that led her from fame into legend, let's say, you know.
So
tell us a little bit about, you know, just the basic concept of what she was going to do and when that was and what the flight path was and just general aspect of it.
Well, I think she'd been taking a couple of long flights, one from Oakland to Honolulu and another from Los Angeles to Mexico. But I think her you know, gigs on the road were sort of diminishing. And so she felt she needed another big accomplishment. And so she came up with this idea, or they came up with this idea of around the world at the equator, which is the widest, obviously, of an around the world trip. There had been other flyers. I don't know if there are women, but other flyers who'd been around the world on a shorter route and others who had taken each aspect of that route. So what she was doing was just a very, very long flight. And so she had to raise money for it and got some investors in Hawaii. Her husband bought her an $80,000 plane, a beautiful silver plane, and she, Lockheed Electra. They went to Hawaii to start this flight, and she was going to have two crew members. One was Fred Noonan, who was her navigator, and another man who was to be the radio operator. And so he pulled out at the last minute because he was nervous she wasn't going to make it. And people did say, you know, she had a 1 in 100 chance of making it. But she was determined, and so was he. And I think they believed that if they completed this trip, she would be set up for life. This would be her swan song. This would be her last big adventure. She was almost 40, mm-hmm. and you know, she'd taken all of the routes that would bring her fame and fortune. So this was the last one. So she took off with Fred Noonan, her navigator in Hawaii, and had an accident at the end of the runway. It just slid off the runway. And so the plane was damaged. And so they had to fly, she was all right, nobody was hurt, but they had to fly the plane to Miami to repair it. And then she took off from Miami. Instead of going from east to west, she was going from west to east. And so she changed her route. She made about 22,000 miles of that trip, stopping in India and Karachi and going flying over Africa. And so she was pretty far along. But when she got to Ley, New Guinea, which is where there's a little bit of footage of her taking off, she called her husband at that time and Eugene Vidal, who the author Gore Vidal was interviewed in my show. And his grandfather was Eugene Vidal, who was an aviation expert at the time. Several people think she was having an affair with him. I had no proof when I made the film, but Gore Vidal said she was having an affair with him. She spoke to her husband and Eugene Vidal. So in any event, she was calling home saying she was very worried about her navigator, Fred Noonan, who was drinking a lot. George and Eugene said, stop, cut it off, come back. You don't need to do this. And she said, no, I'll be okay. And so she took off from Ley, New Guinea, and she had been getting only 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night, had diarrhea, was really weak. But knowing her, she probably pulled herself together, and they got very close to their destination, which was called Howland Island. It's a speck in the middle of the ocean. It's about a mile long. Mm. And if you're in the Pacific, you've got clouds going overhead. It's not so easy to spot an island. And her navigator was relying on celestial navigation, but the map that they had was 5 miles off for Howland Island, number one. Number two, she didn't have a radio operator. They had a radio, but they didn't know how to use it. And she had a trailing wire antenna and Morse code that she left in Miami. She just didn't take them. They were in the way. And so as she approached what she thought was Howland Island, she was communicating with a ship called the Itasca, which was a Navy ship, maybe a Coast Guard ship, that was waiting for her near Howland and planned to guide her to the landing strip on Howland. And they could hear her, but she could never hear them. And so there were some very desperate communications from her and Noonan that they couldn't respond to, or she didn't hear their response. And so she said where she was flying on some particular line of latitude. And so she then just disappeared. They never heard from her again.
Yeah, it was kind of a confluence of everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And there's even footage of her taking off from New Guinea on that airbase and that little, you know, it's a dirt strip basically. And there's a little puff of smoke that appears under her plane at one point, and they think that there was a rock on the runway that caught this trailing wire and popped it, which was her incoming receiving antenna, and they actually found a piece of the wire in the runway later, so they think that basically she could transmit.
Oh, that's what happened. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
As you said, she could transmit but couldn't hear her, so she's flying not blind and kind of half blind in a way, but deaf for sure,
right.
Running
out of fuel.
That's right. And with a navigator who's just recovering from a hangover and, you know, so it's kind of everything that could go wrong, right? So.
And trying to get you to the wrong spot in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah. So just flying desperately back and forth and in the end, just trying to cover ground or cover water and see if they could happen onto the island. But she disappeared on July 2nd, 1937. So I'm going to give a kind of a thumbnail version of what happened shortly after that. There was a massive air and sea search that went on for 16 days, I think the largest sea search in history at that time. It was before World War II. And at $4 million, it was, you know, both the Navy and the Coast Guard got involved. It was the most expensive and intensive search in history, you know, in the U.S. history, but not a single sign was found.
Orchestrated by Roosevelt, who was a friend, and so was his wife, a friend of theirs. Yeah.
Yeah. So none of that is, the fact that there was no sign of it found was not surprising in the vast Pacific, but even today aircraft are lost at sea or even over land and not found for years and sometimes never. I mean, look at the Malaysia flight, right? Air Malaysia. But,
right.
You know, the Earhart disappearance was in the time before radar and communications were primitive by today's standards. And so basically they just flat disappeared. So there have been a number of theories over the years about what happened. I mean, just kind of, you know, some of them are outlandish. One that she was actually conducting a spy flight for the U.S. government who had concerns about the Japanese buildup in power in the Pacific. And so that's kind of a military conspiracy theory that she was captured by the Japanese and later executed. And there are people who purport to have seen her plane on an island that was held by the Japanese. And there are people who say that they saw a white woman brought to a little fort and then executed and buried. So there are these kind of things that go on with mysteries like that, you know, kind of like the JFK assassination or things where there's enough unknown that it's fruitful ground for conspiracy theories to spring up. And if there's no proof of what did happen, then those things flourish, right? But
So, actually,
a few years ago, there was a photo of her on a dock. There was a whole TV show,
yes.
A documentary about that. And it turned out about the time that the documentary aired, it turned out that the photo was from a Japanese tourist brochure that was published before her flight. There you go.
Well, I fell for the photo myself when I saw it before I learned that, because it has a woman sitting on a dock and she's got a shirt like the one she wore in Miami before she was taking off or wherever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody standing like looking a lot like Fred Noonan.
Yeah.
So it did look like them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess there were islanders who said they had seen her. And that's certainly a possibility, but I don't know how we would ever find that out or whether Freedom of Information would ever get access to any of that.
As I said, though, the photo was published before her flight. So,
right.
So
right.
Automatically that excludes that. And then there was the idea that she went down at sea and just, it was, you know, crash and sink and never be seen again. And so that was kind of the leading theory for a long time. Then a group named TIGER turned up, which is the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. And I actually had the president of that group, Rick Gillespie, on a few years ago talking about this.
Oh.
But why don't you kind of give us, you know, a thumbnail version of that theory that they have come up with.
Gillespie seems to believe that she landed on Nikumaroro Island. I can't really say it very well, but which was Gardner Island and about 5 miles south of Howland. And his theory is that she landed there and survived and became, Jean Noonan survived for quite a while on that island. We don't know how long, but certainly lived there for a little bit until whatever happened, they ran out of water or something. But so there had been a photograph taken in the 1940s, number one, by somebody who had explored that island. And he believes that photograph shows a landing wheel in the water. But could be. It looks sort of like one. That's number one. Number two, right after her disappearance, there were a number of radio messages heard. And so people thought, well, maybe she's still alive. And her husband did, too, and kept the search on beyond the government search because of these remaining
radio transmissions. Yeah.
And I'm not sure what was said in any of those. I don't think I've ever read any dialogue in any text about those, but people heard something and was convinced her. So Gillespie started traveling, getting money and raising money and going out in a ship to explore the island. I think they've done 4 or 5 trips. And before their effort, there was a sole of a shoe found and some bones that could have been a mid-height European woman, part of a sextant. So these were clues that he had. He, Gillespie, and his team have been looking for a sort of site where they might have set up camp. But this is an island that gets overwashed with huge waves. So that there would be anything is sort of a long shot. However, he does seem to be able to raise money for these trips. So he seems to be convinced, although without DNA proof, we don't know. And the bones have disappeared, so we can't explore that any further.
Yeah, it was frustrating at the time. In 1940, a pathologist, as you said, the island was called Gardner Island, and it was owned by the British at the time. So somebody was named the governor of the island, which was uninhabited, but they were setting it up to do coconut plantation on it. So a guy came and a British surveyor came and the governor came along with him, and they found the most of the skeleton of a what turned out to look like a female European, and a pathologist examined it. But then the bones were sent to England and never seen again. So there was that. But
yeah,
you know, the idea is that the plane was landed, that they landed the plane more or less safely on a flat reef that was right off the coast of the island, and they were able to keep the motor, the engine, running, and therefore charge the batteries to make radio transmissions. But they could only do it in low tide because they could only get back out to the plane at low tide. So they had a very short window of time to do this. And one of the transmissions that you mentioned, I did read a diary one time of a young woman in St. Petersburg, Florida, who was a ham radio operator. And she wrote down what she was hearing. And it's, you know, pretty much when you read it, it's a woman giving a desperate call for help. And she's talking to someone in the cockpit. She's talking to someone who's a man, who can be heard sounding panicked, and she's trying to get him to stay in the plane and not go out, you know, and he apparently is hurt and she doesn't want him to bleed in the water, you know, so there's a lot of stuff that really made sense. And she's talking about a ship that they can see called, I think it was the City of Norfolk, and the woman wrote it down as City of New York because it sounded like that. And it turns out on Gardner Island, which became Nicomororo, hard to say, down the way from where they think they were, is a wreck of an old tanker called the City of Norfolk. And so pretty clear that, you know, all of that fits together. And they, one of the things they found was the remnants of a little cosmetic bottle. And when a chemist analyzed it, they found that it was the compound in it was something that was sold pretty commonly at that time to people who had blemishes on their skin or to try to get rid of freckles. And Amelia Earhart she was a freckle-faced woman, and she used that particular cosmetic for that purpose. And so there's a lot of circumstantial evidence is pretty strong, but the thing that was sticking up out of the water was on that reef in 1937, a few months after she vanished, and it did look like a landing gear from the Electra, and it had that configuration to it, and then later on it wasn't there. But so the last thing that Tiger did find in their sonar searches was kind of tantalizing evidence on the bottom of something that looks like, you know, very much like man-made debris on the bottom at 600 feet depth or something. And so they would like to go back and dive with an ROV down to this point and actually photograph this object and see if it is her Electra. But anyway, so the whole mystery and the legend continues, and it just continues to intrigue us to this day. But, you know, I'll just give a quote here. Tom Crouch, who's the senior curator of the National Air and Space Museum, has said, "The mystery is part of what keeps us interested. In part, we remember her because she's our favorite missing person."
That's true.
Pretty much it. You can watch Nancy's one-hour documentary online on Amelia Earhart at pbs.org/show/American Experience. Or you can just go to pbs.org and search for American Experience among the shows that they produce, and then search further for Amelia Earhart, or just the word Earhart, E-A-R-H-A-R-T, will get you there. Been a fascinating story, as it always is and remains, and maybe at some point the thing will be definitively proven, what happened to Amelia Earhart. But in the meantime, I want to thank you. Thank you for being on with us on American Variety.
And I appreciate it. It was fun.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.